well and asked me to take his place today in introducing today's speaker at the Miller Center Forum. I have the pleasure today of introducing Max Holland to you. Max has joined the center as one of our resident scholars, and we feel like we were really lucky to get him. Max is what some people might call an independent researcher, which means he's worked for a lot of people and has been a slave to no institution over time. He's been a contributing editor to The Nation magazine. He's been a contributing editor to the Wilson Quarterly. He has written and researched on a variety of subjects related, all of them related to contemporary American history, but comprehending many of its parts. For instance, you're about to find out that Max is possibly the nation, if not the nation's leading, one of the nation's leading experts on all the research and issues surrounding the assassination of President Kennedy, which, as you can imagine, is no small field to master, given the way that has burgeoned over the years. What you might not know is that not so many years ago, Max took on the job, because it interested him for some personal reasons as well as professional reasons, of understanding the decline of the machine tool industry in the United States, epitomized by the Japanese buyout of Budai Industries. There may be one or two people here who remember the fall of Budai, which was one of the cause celebs in the late 1980s and the American concern about how our industrial heart was being bought out and taken over by the Japanese. Max wrote a book on the American machine tool industry and its decline that was then published by Harvard Business School Press and hailed by Business Weeks as one of the finest business books published that year. So you can see, for the Kennedy assassination, the intricacies of the Cold War, LBJ in Congress, the American machine tool industry, Max Holland brings a broad-gauged understanding of American history to his field of study. We're very fortunate to have him at the Miller Center. And without further ado, let me turn the floor over to Max.
Thank you. Thank you, Philip. I'm going to begin by showing the Zapruder film, which, for those of you who haven't seen it, is very graphic and gruesome, and I feel I must apologize to some degree for making it part of this presentation. But there's an important purpose to be served, not merely exploitative, which I hope will be clear at the end of my presentation and transparent. The issue I'd like to pose this morning is what happened in Dealey Plaza, and how did the politics of the Warren Commission influence its language about what occurred, and perhaps other key issues having to do with assassination. Make no mistake, though I am a defender of the accuracy and the integrity of the Warren Commission, I'm not going to stand up here or in any other forum and pretend the commission wasn't influenced by extraneous considerations other than the criminal and forensic facts. At the same time, the politics of the Warren Commission were not what everybody thinks. The commission was not a cover-up, nor was it designed to anesthetize the American people because the truth was too harsh. Its purpose was to assure Americans that everything that needed to be known about the assassination was known. Now I'm going to show the Zapruder film twice. First time will be in real time, and the second in slow motion. Now when you first see it in real time, you'll see President Kennedy wounded and then clutching at his throat. Then Governor Connally obviously wounded. And then finally the third shot, which hit the president in the head.
This is the first of the digital versions and is shown without the images between the sprocket holes. The framing is the standard format.
Thank you. Now, most observers in Dealey Plaza, and there were perhaps 400 to 500 people in Dealey Plaza, heard three shots. There wasn't unanimity about that, but they did hear, the majority of them, three shots, which would suggest that the first shot hit President Kennedy, the second shot hit Governor Connally, and then the third one hit President Kennedy again. But is that really what happened? Could it even happen? For the answer, we have to look at the best evidence, which is the wound suffered by the two men. Of course, in gunshot wounds, it's always the best evidence. We'll start with the third shot first. The Zapruder film says nothing about the direction of the shot that hit the president in the head. In fact, many people who look at it believe that he acted as if he had been shot from the front. But the way you tell the direction of a shot that hits the head is by what they call a beveling effect. In other words, the skull has two surfaces. The surface of entrance is, you see, it has no coning or beveling. The surface of exit always has this beveling. It's similar to, if you've ever seen a plate glass window with a, that a BB hit, and inside, the inside surface has this coning. Now, at Bethesda Naval Hospital, when the doctors did the postmortem and they took out his brain, they looked inside the skull here, and the beveling was on the inside. And when they tried to piece together what remained of the skull here, the beveling was on the outside. And that means only one possibility, which that was that the shot was from the rear in an elevated position. So that was the third shot from the rear. Now let's go backwards to the second shot. This is the infamous magic bullet shot. Now the muzzle velocity of the missile that left the rifle was about 2,100 feet per second. When it hit President Kennedy right about here, it was traveling at 2,000 feet per second. When it exited his throat, traveling mostly through soft tissue, and exiting right above the knot of his tie, it was traveling at 1,700 feet per second. So the question really is, if it didn't hit Governor Connally, where did it go? It had to hit him. These two men were just maybe 16 or 18 inches apart. So while initially the FBI and the Dallas police reported that there had been three shots, and the first hit President Kennedy, the second hit Governor Connally, and the third hit President Kennedy. In fact, the third hit President Kennedy in the head, the second one hit both men. That leaves the question of the first shot, and I'll draw your attention again to the Zapruder film, this time in slow motion.
This is a replay of the standard format version, this time in slow motion.
I'd like to draw your attention to this little girl in a red dress and white coat. If you watch her, she's running across the lawn here to try and see the President and Mrs. Kennedy as long as she can. You'll see that she stops abruptly, very shortly. And when she was asked why she stopped, she said, she heard a loud retort, and in fact, that was the first shot. But because there was a tree obscuring Oswald's view of the limousine at that moment, that shot actually missed everything. So the first shot missed everything, the second one hit both of them again, and the third hit President Kennedy in the head. They're both injured. Now, my talk is actually entitled Richard Russell and Earl Warren's Commission, and I've chosen that aspect because it's actually in their relationship lies the means to understanding how the events in Dealey Plaza were described in the way they were in the Warren Report, and another key issue as well. Richard Russell, the senior senator from Georgia, who had been in the Senate since 1933, was a very reluctant participant in the Warren Commission, not because he was uninterested in the assassination, he was very interested, but he didn't want to serve with Earl Warren. He had no respect for Earl Warren as a jurist. But there was one remark of Warren's in particular that stuck in his craw, and that was Warren's rush to judgment right after the assassination. About 40 minutes after the news came over that President Kennedy had been shot, Earl Warren held a press conference on the lawn of the Supreme Court, and the Chief Justice of the United States ascribed the murder to hatred and bitterness that has been injected into the life of the nation by bigots. At the time, bigots was often a code word for Southerners. He repeated this when he gave a eulogy for President Kennedy on Sunday in the Capitol, where the president was lying in state. For Richard Russell, this rush to judgment was all too typical of Warren and was particularly grating because, of course, the man who had been arrested in conjunction with the assassination was an avowed Marxist-Leninist and not a, quote, bigot at all. Now, why was Richard Russell chosen to serve? Johnson felt that if he could get both Warren and Richard Russell to serve, that probably 90% of responsible opinion in the United States would be satisfied. You have to remember there were two main schools of thought in those first days, with passions running very high on both sides. Because the assassination had happened in Dallas, there was a belief from, let's say, the liberal left that right-wingers had to be behind Lee Harvey Oswald, that he indeed was a patsy, framed to allow the real killers to go free. From the right wing, there was a belief that since Oswald was a self-described Marxist-Leninist who was enamored of Cuba and had lived in the Soviet Union for 2.5 years, that certainly a secret communist agency had to be behind his activity. It was critical to keeping a balance of opinion on the commission to have Russell and Warren both on it, for they represented to their respective communities everything that was virtuous. Johnson also wanted him for two other reasons. One was that, of course, Russell had been Johnson's mentor in the Senate and perhaps his closest friend. It was also important to have Russell serve because it was already clear within 48 hours of the assassination that Oswald's trip to Mexico City had been captured on CIA's continuous surveillance of communist bloc embassies in Mexico City, and that any investigation of the assassination would necessarily involve intelligence sources and methods that everyone wanted to keep secret. Now, the notion of having them on the commission was probably enough to make Johnson tingle with political pleasure. If Russell had only known that Johnson had invoked his name to recruit Earl Warren, he surely would have been furious. But thereafter, he would say he had been conscripted by Johnson, that he hadn't volunteered. And for the longest time, for weeks, even months after the formation of the commission on November 29th, Russell would refuse to call it the Warren Commission, which is the convention whenever you have a commission is to name it after the chairman. In his office, it was called the President's Commission, its official name, or the Assassination Commission. I'd say only until the spring of 64 did he finally start calling it the Warren Commission. Let me make one other point about this early period. In one of their first conversations after the assassination, Russell tells LBJ his own suspicions regarding the assassination. Just as Earl Warren had this nagging suspicion that bigots were really behind it, Russell believed that Cuba was behind it. He told Johnson, "I would not be surprised if Fidel had something to do with it." Now, in the initial commission meetings in December 1963, Russell and Warren surprisingly agreed on many procedural issues. No witnesses were to be called before the commission. They both agreed. They were simply there to review the evidence as presented by the FBI, and their principal duty would be to review it and reconcile any conflicts and differences in the evidence presented to them. They feared if they heard witnesses, they would become hopelessly enmeshed in a very long and drawn-out process. But Russell did want the staff who would constitute the commission to go through the FBI's findings very thoroughly, as he put it, as if they were going to use them to prosecute J. Edgar Hoover himself. The first sign of differences between the two men begins to occur in January when the Warren Commission is being staffed. Earl Warren wants a longtime friend of his to be chief counsel. Russell's very suspicious of that. He had a habit of writing notes to himself after meetings, and in one of these he said, "Must insist on outside counsel, someone who is independent of Earl Warren," because he feared that perhaps Earl Warren was talking in a way that he was going to finger Oswald as the only one complicit in the assassination. There was a desire to have a geographic dispersion among the staff members, so the southern representative on the staff was supposed to be a Georgia lawyer named Morris Abrams. Russell knew Morris Abrams all too well. He was a civil rights lawyer, a Georgian who was practicing in New York City. He did a lot of pro bono work for Martin Luther King. He was involved in the reapportionment case in Georgia that had tremendous political and racial overtones. In short, he was anathema to Russell. And Russell was insulted that this was, quote, the representative of the South that Warren had decided to put on the commission staff. He made his objections known, and Abrams was deselected. And in the note Russell wrote to himself around that time, he said, "For some reason, Earl Warren is stacking this staff with extreme liberals. The reason only could be that his intention was to absolve the communists from any complicity." Russell's estrangement started to deepen in February 1963 as the first witnesses were called before the commission. In particular, he was disturbed over the kid glove treatment of Marina Oswald. Here was a key witness, the only one who could testify as to Oswald's activities in the Soviet Union. Furthermore, she was known to have been less than candid with the FBI, only admitting to certain things when presented with incontrovertible evidence. Yet Earl Warren treated this woman, who Russell considered a communist, extremely solicitously, almost like his own daughter. He explicitly banned a tough cross-examination of her by the commission staff. Thereafter, Russell's attendance begins to wane at the hearings. For in addition to his already considerable duties as chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committees and the Appropriations Committee of the Senate, it was clear that unlike JFK, Johnson was intent on making civil rights legislation a key part of his platform. And LBJ was someone to contend with when it came to legislation. It's even possible that Russell felt sandbagged by Johnson's putting him on the commission, because there was a growing list of witnesses now, and the task on the commission had grown far beyond anything contemplated in December. And Russell was a very conscientious man. He would not affix his signature to any document in which he did not have full confidence. He worried, perhaps, where the commission might go without him or not go. So, on February 24th, 1964, Richard Russell wrote out, had typed, and addressed a letter of resignation to President Johnson. It got to the point that his secretary even asked him how he wanted it delivered, by page or regular mail. But in fact, it was never sent, and exactly why Russell changed his mind at the 11th hour, I've been unable to find out. But on March 1st, he did appear on Face the Nation. in a program largely devoted to the pending civil rights legislation. But the last question on the program, he was asked about this rumor that he was going to resign from the Warren Commission. His answer was that I'm going to stay there to the very best of my ability and undertake to see that all the facts with regard to this great tragedy are made available to the American people. Of course, it is wholly possible that we will never be able to get to the real truth. And by that he meant he wasn't sure we would get to the bottom of a communist plot. 6 weeks after that, he retained a lawyer, Alfredo Scobie, who was a law clerk to his uncle, who was a state court of appeals judge in Georgia. Her task was to help prepare memos and help Russell digest the huge mass of information both coming into and flowing out of the commission offices. For the next 6 months, Russell was missing in action on the Warren Commission. He never attended any hearings and was even rarely seen in the office. But every night he would assiduously weigh and sift the evidence, reading the transcripts, reading Alfredo Scobie's memos. He appeared again on Labor Day weekend, 1964, when he asked to do a final re-examination, cross-examination of Marina Oswald. So with two other members of the commission, he flew down to Dallas and cross-examined her himself. It was certainly the toughest examination she underwent, but really he discovered nothing that she had not already told. On September 18th was the final meeting of the Warren Commission to make sure that there was agreement on the language. The importance of a unanimous report was manifest to Earl Warren. He feared that anything less and the whole job that the commission had undertaken would be for naught because the attention of the press would be on the dissents. It would be especially problematic if Richard Russell were to dissent. And unfortunately, the only commissioner who did come in with dissents was Richard Russell on two key issues. One was the single bullet conclusion reached by the Warren Commission staff. And the second issue was the question of a foreign conspiracy or involvement with Lee Harvey Oswald. The staff was quite confident. They wanted flat statements from the Warren Commission that one bullet, the second shot, had hit both men, John Connally and President Kennedy, and that there was no foreign conspiracy. Richard Russell weighed in with two caveats, showing strength of mind, judgment, and discrimination, but also misplaced pride. First, as to the conspiracy question, while the staff wanted a blanket no, Russell said he would simply not go along with that. He had suspected Cuban involvement from the outset. He said Oswald lived in Minsk. Minsk is a place where there are a lot of Cuban students. How do we know he wasn't recruited there? And in time, the staff of the Warren Commission came to see the qualification introduced by Russell to be a very good one. Because it was true, the United States had no assurance, it could not be certain, that there wasn't information in Soviet or Cuban archives that showed some connection with Lee Harvey Oswald. Consequently, the final language of the Warren Report reads this way. Because of the difficulty of proving negatives to a certainty, the possibility of others being involved with Oswald cannot be established categorically. But if there is any such evidence, it has been beyond the reach of all the investigative agencies and resources of the United States and has not come to the attention of this commission. Therefore, on the basis of the evidence before the commission, it concludes that Oswald acted alone. On the single bullet conclusion, and I call it a conclusion rather than a theory, Russell's intervention was much less helpful. The basic problem had to do with John Connally. In his testimony before the Warren Commission and in his public statements, he was adamant about one thing despite viewing the Zapruder film many, many times. He wanted his own bullet. He insisted that he had been wounded independently of the president. According to him, The president was shot, then he was shot, and then the president was shot again. He did not, it was a psychological problem, really. He did not want to believe that his near-mortal injury had been suffered accidentally. Now, Russell, because of his time away from the commission, was less conversant with these details. He was convinced Oswald did it and paid less attention to the facts, the criminal and forensic facts. But as I said at the outset, you have to believe in the single bullet theory, because otherwise, because otherwise you're left with this problem of a bullet exiting President Kennedy's throat and going where? That would be a real magic bullet. Or putting it another way, to say that two separate shots hit President Kennedy and Governor Connally is tantamount to saying there were two shooters, and of course, if there are two shooters, there's by definition a conspiracy. For Russell, it became a point of Southern pride not to let Earl Warren contradict the sworn word of a Southern governor. He would not let the commission say that Connally's testimony was incorrect. And he would not yield on this point either. Consequently, if you read the Warren report, the language reads this way. One, the weight of the evidence indicates that there were three shots fired. Two, the shots which killed President Kennedy and wounded Governor Connally were fired by Lee Harvey Oswald. Three, and this is a paragraph that practically defies common sense. Although it is not necessary to any essential findings of the commission to determine just which shot hit Governor Connally, there is very persuasive evidence from the experts to indicate that the same bullet which pierced the president's throat also caused Governor Connally's wounds. However, Governor Connally's testimony and certain other factors have given rise to some difference of opinion as to this probability. But there is no question in the mind of any member of the commission that all the shots which caused the president's and Governor Connally's wounds were fired from the sixth floor window of the Texas School Book Depository. And I would argue that paragraph is logically inconsistent, and in fact the staff who understood the forensics were very upset because they felt it was tantamount to saying if Governor Connally was injured in the way he maintained, there was a conspiracy. Now, in 1964, right after the Warren Report was released in September, and again in 1966 and 1970, Russell would talk about his views. He would frankly say that he was not satisfied with some answers of the Warren Report, and this would be interpreted by the press as a dissent, that Richard Russell did not believe the report that he signed. But in fact, he wasn't dissenting from the language as negotiated in the Warren Report. He was simply averring his particular point of view that we just didn't know the whole story of Oswald, that something happened in Russia, or maybe something happened in the Cuban embassy or in Mexico City that we didn't know. Now, of course, since then, the Russian archives have been opened, and we now know, if you do believe that we've had access to the full record, that Oswald was never recruited and or brainwashed in Russia. In fact, he was under suspicion all the time as an American agent, and that his home and all his friends were either bugged or informers. And I think that someday when the Cuban archives are opened, we'll find that they were terrified at the thought of being blamed for the assassination because of this man who had visited their embassy in Mexico City just 6 weeks before the assassination. With respect to the single bullet conclusion, John Connally went to his death steadfastly maintaining that he had been injured by his own bullet, as did Russell. But every test, besides the logic, every test, and there have been many advanced tests since 1964, shows that the single bullet conclusion is right. I'd like to conclude with this observation about Russell's work on the Warren Commission. He did the job as he defined it, his principal duty being to reconcile conflicts in the evidence, look for missing parts of Oswald's life. I think if he had played a larger role in the commission, some problems surely would have been avoided. There would have been greater clarity in the description of what happened in Dealey Plaza. As important, there would have been more skepticism about the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Russell had uncanny insight into human nature, and he had a lot of respect for Hoover, but was not in awe of him, and he realized the Bureau's tender spots. In fact, at one of the very first meetings, he said, "It would be wise not to investigate the FBI's performance independently at the outset of the investigation, only because it would be necessary to do this later." Well, that never happened. And it was embarrassing when the information that the FBI withheld from the Warren Commission came out some 12 years later. But it's also true that no matter what Russell did or what other members of the commission did, it would probably not lay this matter to rest today. Because as Russell says in response to a reporter the day the Warren Commission report was turned in, the reporter asked, "Are you glad it's over?" And Russell responded, "Do you really think it's over? They'll be debating this thing 100 years. That concludes my presentation. I'll be glad to take questions. Yes?
How did Ruby fit into that picture?
Well,
do any looking into that?
Yes, I'm not. My work is not a reinvestigation as much as it's an attempt to put history, the history of the commission's investigation, into context. I do agree with the commission's conclusion that Ruby was simply a vigilante who had an opportunity, unexpected, to kill the man who killed the president, and he did it because he felt Oswald was the guilty party, and that people would probably want to meet Jack Ruby after he did it. Yes?
Some analysts feel that it's difficult to explain why Oswald received such favorable treatment and housing when he was in Russia, or that lady would hook up with such a loser as Oswald was. Have you any comments on that?
Well, he received favorable treatment, I believe, because the Russians really didn't know what to make of him. They didn't know if this was some kind of new devious American method to get spies into the Soviet Union. So he was given a big apartment in Minsk, but as I said, he was put under surveillance. His bedroom, his phone, his living room were tapped. All his, quote, friends were in fact informants for the KGB. For the first 6 months of his 2.5 years there, he was followed constantly. As for Marina Oswald, I think she saw him when they met as a ticket out of the Soviet Union. She didn't have much of a family there. She was trained as a pharmacist. Despite the propaganda, she believed there was a better life in America. And although she didn't marry him with the intention of going to America, when he got tired of the Soviet Union, she was more than happy to leave with him. Yes?
Gives several reasons for it, but Abrams was a Jew, and you don't mention that, and I was just curious if that factor was relevant to Russell's view of him.
I don't think really. It was simply, I mean, there was a Jewish black alliance in the civil rights movement, but if he had been a Christian and representing Martin Luther King, I'm sure Russell would have been just as upset with him. Yes?
He was one who later, I think, with a co-author, published a biography of Oswald.
Right. I didn't mean by my presentation to leave out the other five members, because they weren't potted plants. They all have very interesting stories. They worked as a group, but then they also did things that they didn't tell each other about. Gerald Ford was probably the most interesting member of the commission because he was the youngest. And for him, the commission was the first appointment of any national prominence. Prior to that, he had been just an up-and-coming congressman from Michigan. And he, like Russell, came to the commission believing there was a communist plot. And he felt that his service on the commission would be roughly akin to Richard Nixon's on the House Un-American Activities Committee. In other words, he didn't trust Earl Warren to find the communists behind it, but Gerald Ford was going to. So he hired three people. Russell had one, but he hired three people, and he set them up in an apartment near Capitol Hill. And although they had no clearances, they were given access to all the top secret information that was made available to the commissioners, and they would help him draw up the questions. And he was the most perfect attendee, probably even more than Warren himself, at all the commission's hearings. And when they had the final meeting about the language, although he knew the facts weren't there to prove that there was communist involvement, he did want some statement about this being the logical act of a man who professes belief in communism. But Earl Warren wasn't going to have any of that kind of ideology, so he refused to allow that language. And because it was Gerald Ford and not Richard Russell, he could make him back down. Subsequently, Ford used his service to get a article in Life magazine describing the work of the Warren Commission, which again upset Earl Warren very much because he felt no one should be taking advantage of the service on the commission to advance their careers or their interests, financial interests. And then Ford did even more than that. He signed a book contract with Simon & Schuster and came out with a book which was really just a rewrite of the Warren Report. Yes?
In your studies, did you find any motivation for why Oswald would shoot the president?
Well, I believe Oswald, a good parallel would be Timothy McVeigh. I think Oswald was both psychologically alienated and you'd say, I'm not an expert in this field, but I think he obviously wasn't a normal personality. He was a narcissistic. He thought he was the most important person in the world. He used to tell Marina about how he was going to be president one day and had all these fanciful ideas. But I also believe he was politically motivated, that every time he acted out his internal demons, it was on a political stage. And he didn't have any great animus to President Kennedy. I think the triggering fact was that he realized President Kennedy was going to be passing right below him. He had actually bought the rifle he used to kill a right-wing general in Dallas named Edwin Walker, because Walker had wanted to drop an atomic bomb on Cuba during the missile crisis. And one of the interesting things about the commission is they couldn't understand why someone who attempted to kill Walker in April 1963 would then want to kill President Kennedy. Of course, from Oswald's point of view, they weren't opposite poles. They were, in fact, a lot closer. Yes?
Have you ever gone into the mechanics of the shooting?
Well, I do go into how the commission develop the single bullet conclusion.
Well, I'm specifically referring to the cadence of the shots. I believe there were 17 Secret Service men who testified 3 days apart, right after the shooting and then 3 days later. And if my information is correct, 14 of those 17 said the shots came like this, which would totally eliminate one shooter. Do you have any verification of that?
Well, you are correct, but I don't think it eliminates one shooter. Everybody that I've talked to who was there, and a lot of the testimony indicates that the first shot sounded, there was a longer period of time, and then the second and third were much closer together. But I don't see how that eliminates.
Well, it eliminates it because of the bolt action of the rifle. If he was shooting with an M1, it'd be a different story, but he was shooting a bolt action. Mm-hmm. And the cadence of the shots, to my information, practically eliminates a single shooter.
Well, if you were to take a stopwatch and time the Zapruder film, it's 26 seconds, and if you believe, as I do, that the first shot was when the limousine was closest to the window, it's approximately 12 seconds that Oswald had to fire three shots. It takes 2.5 seconds to work the bolt. So to get, the bolt is already loaded, to work it takes 2.5 seconds, to work it again takes another 2.5 seconds. That's maybe 6 seconds, and he had 12, so I don't think it's much of an issue. Yes?
How did Oswald learn to shoot that well?
He was a Marine.
He must have been chosen because of his skill with the rifle.
Well, he was in the Marines, and he was a marksman in the Marines. Yes?
You refer to the fact that a substantial amount of evidence was withheld by the FBI from the commission, and that Russell had some knowledge of this and didn't push for it. And I'm curious, one of the explanations, that Russell was afraid that if the FBI informants on the assassination began to be challenged, that the surveillance activities the FBI was doing against Kidd and a wide range of civil rights and liberal activities in the South at that time also would become public knowledge of this.
No, that's not. I didn't mean to say he knew that the FBI was withholding information, but he was shrewd enough in the ways of the federal government, unlike Warren, that he suspected that there ought to be an independent evaluation of the FBI's performance. Now, what he didn't know and what no one knew is that 10 days before the assassination, Oswald had gone in to the Dallas field office of the Bureau and handed a note to the receptionist. First, he wanted to see the agent who had been visiting his wife, an agent named James Hostey, because the FBI was concerned when they found that that Oswald was resubscribing to the Militant and other communist newspapers. So their interest in him had reawakened after being dormant for about a year after his return. And Oswald felt constrained and under surveillance. So he delivered a protest note which said, if you want to find out about me, stop asking my wife, come directly to me, or something along that line. The receptionist took it, she gave it to the agent, he threw it in his desk, he thought it was just guff, that's what he put it. After Oswald was arrested, the receptionist realized that this was the man who had come to the FBI 10 days before. So while Hostey was at the Dallas police headquarters, his supervisor rummaged through his desk, found the note. When Hostey came back to the FBI, he said, "What the hell is this?" Hostey was in a very difficult place explaining the circumstances of the note, and he prepared a memo about it that night, Friday night, while the rest of the nation was in mourning. Hostey was writing how he happened to receive the note from the man who was probably going to be charged with the assassination. And the note and the memo stayed in his supervisor's desk until Sunday afternoon. When Oswald was murdered, the FBI figured that nobody else knew about this note, so Hostey was ordered to flush it down a toilet along with his memo. And this information didn't come out for 12 years. Yes?
As a legitimization project, the Warren Commission, which you said, how would you evaluate it in terms of what has now become a kind of standard sort of declension sort of theory about the legitimacy of American institutions, government, in terms of usually, you know, Warren Commission, Vietnam, domestic upheaval. This is the beginning of declension, and, you know, and statistic, the polling data is very clear from the 60s to the 90s decline in institutional. Do you see it as a a success from that point of view, or do you see it in fact as a failure?
Well, that's a very good question. I guess you'd have to say it's a bit of a failure when, you know, according to different polls, 70% to 90% of the American people believe there was a conspiracy and that the government was either too incompetent or corrupt or maybe even involved in the assassination itself. So by that standard, it's a failure. But obviously, I think if you took another poll and asked the American people about the facts, they'd prove to be remarkably ignorant. They know all the supposed contradictions, you know, that you can't fire a rifle that quickly, or that people thought the shot came from the grassy knoll and all that kind of stuff. But they really don't know the basic facts, and there's just a mountain of evidence against Oswald.
I mean, it seems to me that LBJ was very intelligent in his, he understood this problem, and he got Warren and Russell, as you said, covering 90% of the political opinion. So he was smart, and it should have, and then they came out with a roughly unanimous opinion. It should have succeeded. So maybe it was irrelevant, sort of, what precisely the Warren Commission came up with. One was going to get this delegitimization of American institutions regardless, and then in ex post facto, the Kennedy assassination becomes one of the hooks upon which this decline in sense of authority, et cetera, is put upon.
To give you an adequate answer, I'd have to really trace what happened in the 30-odd years after the Warren Commission. If you look at the history, in 64, and I'd say basically through 65, the Warren Report was respected. The decline in trust really started in 66 when it became apparent that the commission had not done an independent evaluation of the autopsy photos and x-rays. And this was the first chink, I'd say, in the armor of the commission. And the reason that wasn't done was because of the Kennedy family. Robert Kennedy did not want those photos or x-rays out of the family's control for even a moment. And this goes back to what I said earlier, that if Russell had been more active, I think some of the commission's problems might have been avoided, because Russell was a stickler for procedure. He would have said to the Kennedys, I believe, that we have our job to do. We will take your sensitivity and do everything we can to protect your interests and not have these photos appear in the National Enquirer, but we have to do our job. Earl Warren, who is I think overly sympathetic or sensitive to the Kennedy family, let that issue pass. Now, this is a whole other aspect of the assassination, but the autopsy had been done very irregularly, and there was very good reason to have the whole thing submitted to an independent evaluation. But Earl Warren didn't let that happen, and it was to the chagrin of the commissioners and the staff. In fact, there was a big argument at the time. Arlen Specter, who's now the senator from Pennsylvania, was on the staff, and he was demanding independent evaluation. Warren refused. And McCloy, years later, said if he had to do one thing over, it would have been to submit that important evidence to an independent examination. Now, retroactively, after that, Watergate and Vietnam, people looked back at the commission and felt that it was as dishonest as some of the things that had happened later. But I'm trying to fight that. Yes?
Is ordinarily loaded with 6 cartridges, the clip for which becomes part of the mechanism during which the cartridges are fed into the chamber. Now, here we have Oswald going into the Texas Book Depository with a smaller package than the overall length of the rifle, which presupposes that he reassembled 5 screws in order to put the gun back together. Then we have 3 cartridge cases and 1 round removed from the chamber. Is there any indication as to what happened to the other 2 cartridges? And how come Oswald was able to reassemble a rifle so that it went right back to zero and was able to shoot it accurately?
Well, I'm not a ballistics expert, and I'm not going to pretend I know the precise answers to your questions, but I do know that someone took that rifle apart and reassembled it before the Warren Commission in about 10 minutes using a quarter.
Oh, yeah, that can be done. But to put it back to zero is another matter entirely, and that is to say, when he shot it on the range with the scope, if he did, and adjusted it, then when it's put back together again, it may or may not go back to the same position. In other words, there are pressures within the bedding of the barrel and the wood stock and things like that, and also the tension on the screws that have to do with the way the barrel behaves when the bullet passes down it. And those greatly affect accuracy. Go to any target range and ask to take apart somebody's favorite target rifle and he'll ask you to leave the range.
Probably, but he did it nevertheless.
Well, and then what happened to the other two cartridges? Since if you try to load that with fewer than six cartridges, it can be done, but it's like loading an M1 rifle with fewer than eight cartridges. It's not normal. It's an extraordinary thing. It's like going, you know, if you're going to assassinate somebody, I would assume you'd want a full magazine.
Probably, but I think that's what happened. He did it. Yes?
Two questions. Would you speak further on Robert Kennedy's impact on the commission? And also, you didn't mention the information that was withheld from the commission, I think, from the CIA.
Well, this is another aspect of the commission's work and has also been a main reason why the commission's fallen into great disfavor. The fact is, of course, at the time, the United States was trying to remove Fidel Castro. And this was known to one member of the commission, Alan Dulles. It was not known or told to the other members of the commission. I think the logic of the CIA was that if there was no link between Castro or any agent of Castro and Oswald, whatever we were doing to Castro was only important in the recesses of Oswald's mind. If he believed we were trying to assassinate Castro, maybe that's why he did it. Or maybe he didn't even have to believe that. He knew we were hostile to Castro. But the CIA acted towards the commission on a need-to-know basis. They provided everything the commission needed to know to do their job, extremely sensitive intelligence, but they wouldn't provide information that they felt ought to be kept secret, and there was no good reason to tell the commission. Now, if you talk to the members of the staff today, you'll find a division of opinion on whether they should have been told. They did investigate the Cuban connection. It's not like because they didn't have this information, they didn't look at connections to Cuba. They looked and looked very hard. What this additional information would have done is a very good question. I don't think they would have come to a different conclusion. Certainly the CIA didn't, and the CIA had every interest in finding out if there was a Cuban connection, Warren Commission or no Warren Commission. Some of the members of the staff believe that they should have been told because they're lawyers and lawyers like to know everything. Other members of the staff believe that the CIA would have betrayed the Warren Commission only if they withheld evidence of some link between Cuba and Oswald, which would suggest then that our attempt to assassinate Castro was an act of retaliation. But in fact, there is no link. I believe there is no link, and you'll never find a link between Oswald and Cuba. The thing about Robert Kennedy, and one of the most misunderstood things about the Warren Commission, is that Robert Kennedy, it's not just the CIA who didn't tell the Warren Commission about the assassination attempts, it was also Robert Kennedy, who was the person who was probably riding herd, not probably, who was riding herd on the CIA on behalf of his brother to get rid of Castro. So either you have to hold and criticize both Robert Kennedy and the CIA for not telling the Warren Commission, or else you try to understand why both didn't.
I could just add a small note to that, since I work a little bit of the history of this period too. The assassination efforts against Castro, especially after, say, mid-1961, dwindled to a scale that only a tiny number of people were even aware of. The director of the CIA was not aware of these activities. This is because they had no scale. By 62, 63, such desultory, feckless efforts as were still being pursued in CIA to assassinate Castro were in the realm of two, three people, perhaps, at the most, none of whom reported even to the director of CIA. and these activities, and possibly Bobby Kennedy was aware of these activities, although we're not even sure of that. We are sure that Bobby Kennedy was aware of some of the initial efforts that had more or less lapsed by mid-1961. We don't even know whether or not he had approved of those efforts. There's still persistent controversy about that. But the point is, in the question, is you shouldn't imagine that CIA as an institution, quote unquote, knew about assassination plots against Castro. Maybe a few people somewhere in CIA knew, but the people at CIA who were actually interacting with the commission might not have known, by and large, anything about such assassination plots and might not have been concealing anything.
Let me just add on that point, the
another person who's gone through this.
I also knew the personally the CIA's representative who interacted with the Warren Commission. His name was Raymond Rocca. He was the head of research and analysis for the counterintelligence staff of the CIA. The counterintelligence staff of the CIA was not told about the assassination attempts. This was kept outside of that realm of the CIA, and therefore Mr. Rocca and his boss, James Angleton, could not have provided this information to the Warren Commission.
Thank you. So this is all true. Yes. Yes?
What was the objective of the Assassination Records Review Board, which was operating here 3 years ago?
Well, after Oliver Stone's movie came out in 1991, I don't know if you remember, but at the end, it made an allusion to all the government documents that were still classified about the Kennedy assassination. So there was a great public outcry. Why were these documents still secret? In response, Congress passed a law called the Assassination Materials Act. It instructed the president to appoint a board that would review all these documents and with the presumption of disclosure, and most classification law is the presumption of secrecy. But this was a special case, so it made the presumption of immediate disclosure. So from 1993, roughly, till just this past year, 1998, this five-person board reviewed documents from the National Security Agency, the FBI, CIA, the National Labor Relations Board, the IRS, every agency that had documents about the assassination. And most of them have now been released. But if you look at the kinds of documents that are released, you'll see that they have everything to do with intelligence sources of and methods, but don't change the conclusions of the Warren Report one iota. Yes? Yes, they did interview people.
The records.
They did interview people to try and establish perhaps what had happened, the missing records or alleged records. They did interview people. Yes?
Was Oswald's diary then used?
To whom?
To the investigations.
There's an interesting story about that. The diary was actually leaked in the summer of 1964 to Life magazine, which published big excerpts of it. It was leaked by people in Dallas who felt that the city was being blamed for the assassination when a communist, in fact, had done it. But the diary just really showed, I think, Oswald's grandiosity and his outsized dreams and his sense of self-importance, inflated self-importance. It really didn't establish any facts. Yes?
Notwithstanding all the facts about Oswald, and not hoping to be facetious, but have they ever considered an internal plot like the Johnson and Hoover?
At the commission, you mean? No, to be honest, I would have to say they did not consider an internal plot. They didn't believe that any agency of the U.S. government was involved. They did believe that perhaps the Secret Service, FBI, and CIA had somehow failed in their duties to help protect the president, but they didn't ever countenance the idea that those agencies were involved in overthrowing the government. I don't believe so. Yes?
Correctly, that Adlai Stevenson was in Texas and maybe in Dallas or somewhere, and he phoned the Kennedy office and urged him not to come. Where would he have gotten it since the feeling there was danger there?
Well, this goes back to the, I'd say, the knee-jerk reaction after the assassination that right-wingers were responsible. Adlai Stevenson had visited Dallas in October to make a speech in an observance of UN Day. And he spoke in the Civic Auditorium, and as he was leaving, he was spit at. People threw things at him. They rocked his car, and a person nearly got run over, and he was praised for his aplomb and coolness under that vicious demonstration. But in fact, he thought the president should not go to Dallas because there might be an incident like that. So for the next month or so, he wavered between trying to tell the president he should keep Dallas off his itinerary in Texas, and knowing that if he did that, the president would probably think he was cowardly and too soft and sentimental, because the president, President Kennedy, liked to confront people who he thought were extremists. He probably looked forward to giving the speech in the trademark, which was going to, in fact, condemn that kind of extremist rhetoric that Dallas was known for. So he did warn, but he didn't warn, and he was sort of tortured by the issue. But that incident, that demonstration against him, was why, when the assassination did in fact happen, that people immediately leapt to the conclusion that it had to be right-wingers, because look at what had happened to Adlai Stevenson. Yes?
The other evening there was a very extensive biography on John Gotti and his connection with the mafia, and Joe Kennedy's connection with him, paying him to use his organization to deliver votes for Jack Kennedy. Then Bobby comes in with his campaign against organized crime, and the sum and substance of it was that Gotti felt that he had been betrayed by the Kennedys and so on, and that there was a contract out on Kennedy's head, and that this was known, didn't say to whom, was known by the government that there was a contract out on it. Do you know, is there anything to all this?
I mean, there was a contract on Robert Kennedy or John Kennedy?
John Kennedy.
Well, the truth is that after the assassination, the person who was most interested in, of course, finding out who did it was Robert Kennedy. And long before the Warren Commission ever got started, he mounted his own investigation, relying on his own investigators. And Robert Kennedy believed that there were most likely three parties responsible. One was the Teamsters, maybe in league with the Mafia, maybe the Mafia itself, or the Cubans, either pro or anti-Castro Cubans. And he had his crack investigators look at all those possibilities. And of course, this is on Friday, November 22nd. This is already going into gear. And of course, after Ruby kills Oswald, it seems even more pregnant that there's some kind of Teamster or mobster, because Ruby's obviously a low-level hoodlum. But Robert Kennedy couldn't find anything. And I believe his interest in finding the truth was sincere, and I don't believe there is anything.
Last question.
It's always curious that in August of 1963 in Germany, Jack Kennedy had a conference with an Albert Oswald, and always wondered what that was about. And in December of 63, there being a lot of newspaper stories of three shots in 5 seconds, no, it's not possible, etc. I wrote an article on how and why Jack Kennedy was killed using the second shooter and a reloaded bullet type idea. My agent took photographs in the shooting range proving all of this as being theoretically possible, and the story was sold to Stern magazine for 1,000 Deutsche Marks and suppressed.
Well, I'm afraid I disagree with the premise of your question. There weren't three shots in 5 seconds.
There were three shots in about 12 seconds. From the Belgian newspaper. I'm just saying that this is some of the dialogue at that time, and that prompted my writing the story as to how it could be done. That's what happened to the other two bullets. Fired into a water trap and loaded into a larger caliber arm with a sapple. You know, I mean, just throw that out for your thoughts.
Well, like I say, I do believe that if you put together the best evidence with the representation of what happened that you see in the Zapruder film, you see it's quite possible for Oswald to have accomplished his feat of arms. In fact, there is no other explanation that makes sense